You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Joining me today on this Tuesday is Ted Studdard, retired Marine, and he's a writer. And so we're going to meet him. We're going to learn about the book that he's written, Depot to Depot, and a transformational leadership journey from the military to corporate America. So first of all, Ted, welcome to All Marine Radio.
Thanks so much, Mac. I am absolutely honored to be here.
Oh, that's good. That's good. The before we talk about the book, we got to learn about you. So to decide as Marines if we can believe anything you say. So tell us about you. Born and raised where?
Well, you know, never let the truth get in the way of a good story, right?
Exactly.
Oh gosh. So you know, I started off as a private in 1984 at Parris Island, and I retired as a colonel in 2013.
Well, hold on. Born and raised where?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Commerce, Georgia. I know my accent never gives me away, but born and raised in Commerce, and I went to the University of Georgia.
All right, so you're born and raised in Commerce, and then how does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
You know, great question. My dad and my uncle were both Marines, and my uncle fought in World War II, Guadalcanal, Peleliu, and New Britain with 5th Marines and the 1st Marine Division. And, you know, he never talked about battle, but you could just see the impression that the Marine Corps made on him. And my dad also served between Korea and Vietnam, and the same thing, you know. He never talked a lot about the day-to-day, but you could just sense the pride he had in being a Marine. And, you know, I just wanted to be a Marine when I grew up. I didn't care what I did. I didn't care where I went. I just wanted to be a Marine. I wanted to go to Parris Island because that's where my dad and my uncle started off. And, you know, of course, they did their 4 years and then moved on into business afterwards. And that was my plan when I started.
All right. So you, you enlisted at high school. And what do you become as a private out of recruit training?
You know, I was dangerous, is what I was. I was a stinger gunner, and it was funny. I was assigned to my first unit, and they told me I was going to be a radio operator. And thought, you know, I didn't sign up to be a radio operator. I was going to be a gunner. And of course, you all have your recruiting stories, and I had visions when I heard the word gunner. That I was going to be standing in a helicopter, you know, shooting machine guns out of the door of a helicopter. And it was funny, when I got to that first unit, they said, you're a radio operator. I had no idea. And, you know, quite frankly, I didn't care. But come to find out, it was with a Stinger unit, and I got transferred into being a Stinger gunner. And I did that for about 6 months, and while I was at the University of Georgia, I saw the officer candidate, or the OSO, and they asked me, do you want to be an officer? And that was pretty easy. I was a private first class at that point, so I said, yes, sir, what do I need to do?
So you graduate from recruit training, you go, are you an air defense guy by MOS? What do you buy MOS?
Yeah, by defense. I turned out to be a Stinger gunner, and I was in the local reserve unit. I was going to the University of Georgia, and I was in the reserve unit in Marietta. And so while I was there, and of course going to Georgia, that's how I met the OSO.
Got it. And then
ended up in the PLC program.
All right. So you joined the PLC program. When do you finish college?
Gosh, I finished college in 1988 and was commissioned, right after I graduated.
So you go to the basic school in the fall of 88?
Go to the basic school in November of 88.
Then I taught you.
And you did indeed. You did indeed. This is a small world.
Yeah, I got there in March of 89. I had come off sea duty and went to the basic school. And what a riot. So then out of the basic school, where do you become?
You know, so I leave the basic school and as an artilleryman. And I go to my first unit, which is Bravo 112 in Kaneohe Bay, Hawaii. And it was just a dream come true to be, not only to be a Marine in the fleet, but to be a Marine officer in Bravo 112. It was absolutely a dream come true.
Wow. Well, did you like Hawaii? Not like Hawaii? What was the, you know, you hear mixed responses to guys about their experience in Hawaii. What about you?
You know, I absolutely loved it. We were gone. Melissa and I had gotten married after the basic school and before we went to Hawaii. So we were newlyweds, and we were deployed for over two of the 3 years that we were in Hawaii. And so those short times.
So maybe I should ask Melissa, how did Melissa enjoy Hawaii?
You know, I think Melissa absolutely loved Hawaii. But you know the deal. It was just like a honeymoon every time we came back, and it was just absolutely phenomenal. But really what made it special is the Marines that I got to serve with. I think that is probably, of all the units I have served with, that group of Marines is probably as close, if not closer, than any group I've ever been with. And we still stay in contact today. And I think that's what made it so special.
Wow, that's awesome. Because, you know, not every unit, especially, you know, to stay in touch with guys that long ago when you were a second lieutenant and whatnot, I mean, you got to go find those guys. Because it's not like now when Marines get out, they got each other's phone number, they're linking on Facebook and all these other social media apps. And so they have a network that will stand them in good stead as they get older. But you had to go find people back in the day.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the beauty of this is we still get together. In fact, I guess we had 40 of us from the battery that was in from, you know, the 89 to 92, 93 time frame that got together in Las Vegas last summer. And it was just one of the most special events I've ever had in my life.
I want to ask you a question about that because, you know, I meet people all the time that have those experiences. Is there any warmer place in the world than being among your comrades, your fellow Marines?
You know, there's not. And the beauty of it is after all these years, we pick up just like it was yesterday. And you know that no matter what happened, you've got a guy on your left, your right, your front, your rear, and they're there. They are there no matter what. And that's hard to describe. You know exactly what I'm talking about, but that is something that is so special that I think we have as Marines. Just one of those intangibles that's a lifetime gift.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's always cool, especially, you know, and what's interesting, a lot of guys get very intimidated by that. You know, I've had guys who, you know, have been to reunions, Vietnam guys that have told me that, I went and I drove around the block and then I went home the first time. For whatever reason, I was intimidated to go in. You know, I was afraid, you know, a lot of units that had been in combat, you know, I was going to dredge up a bunch of memories. So I drove 1,000 miles, drove around the hotel where everybody was for 2 hours, and then I drove home. And so I never pass up the point, you know, to tell, you know, Marines that go through this that, you know, there is no warmer, funnier place in the world to be around, you know, the men and women that you served with and that you went through so much with. And just if there's any doubt in your mind, well, should I go, should I not go, always go. Because it's, first of all, it's a hoot. And second of all, reconnecting with people that, you know, you shared so much with and is one of the coolest things that we have going as a tribe.
No, you are so absolutely spot on. There's just being connected with people who know you, understand you, and just absolutely love you for who you are and what you are, and it doesn't matter. And they'll be there at the end. It's absolutely replaceable.
And they know most, and they know all of it too. It's not like you can hide. Yeah. It's not like you can hide it from those guys, those girls. I mean, they know most of it.
Yes, they've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Exactly. So take us through, take us through some of your career. Give me the high watermarks of your career, Ted.
Well, you know, we talked about that first tour with Bravo 112, but, you know, like you, I had an opportunity to teach at the basic school. And I think as far as not being in the fleet, that was just a tremendous opportunity. And to be around such a group of peers that were at the top of their game and just absolutely totally focused on war fighting and really the essence of being a Marine, and that environment to study your craft, to learn your craft, and just to be a Marine every day, every waking minute of every day was just incredible. And it's funny, the group or the peers that I have stayed in contact with and feel closest to, it's that group of guys that I served with at the basic school. And it's so funny. There's a core group of guys that we were together at the basic school. We were recruiting station commanders together.
Right.
And then we're in Afghanistan together. And, you know, it's just it's pretty indescribable to have that kind of camaraderie through the years and that linkage.
Now, you know, again, I had a similar experience, and I'm still close friends, you know, and talk to them, and they're still a huge part of my life, it's a special place, and I think if you talk to most of us, and you say, other than your combat, you know, deployments and those units, if you eliminated all them, what's your favorite, you know, and I would tell you 99% would say, my time at the basic school, because I really separated as a professional. I met just really great people that are still in my life. So it's interesting. You start out, you go there, then after the basic school, where do you go?
So after the basic school, I go back to the fleet and I serve in 2nd Battalion, 11th Marines. And then I have a wonderful opportunity to go out to 29 Palms and be part of the CACS program as Coyote 2-2. And then, of course, go to school, Command and Staff College, but then had one of those unique experiences. I was a recruiting station commander for Recruiting Station Nashville. And one of those things you just didn't want to do, you know, golly Pete, take me there kicking and dragging. And but, you know, of all the duties I had, Mac, I think I learned more about leadership and really more about just what it really means to be a Marine and moral courage and ethical leadership. And, you know, I talked a lot about the Marines in Bravo 112. The other unit that I think is as close, and we still stay in touch as well, is that team of Marines I served with in Recruiting Station Nashville. And you talk about a team that's under the gun every day. And no matter what you do, you're under the microscope. And these guys just... they were phenomenal to serve with. They taught me so much. And obviously, you know, you can never repay that.
No. And again, as you said, recruiting duty, I mean, the pressure on recruiters in the Marine Corps to do it and to do it right, because the pressure is immense. And when it's not going good, you know, you read the stories all the time about people that get outside the lines and it doesn't work out very well most of the time when they do that. And that shared thing is pretty important. After that, where do you go?
So after that, after recruiting duty, I take command of 3rd Battalion, 12th Marines in Okinawa. And then from Okinawa, I come back to the U.S. I go to the National War College in Washington, D.C. And then I go to the Pentagon. And I end up leading the team that did current operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan in the J-33. And then from there, I go to Afghanistan and was initially the deputy operations officer. Then I became the operations officer for the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force Ford. And then I came back to the U.S. and took command of the 8th District and then retired from there.
So you retire from there, and I read in a little blurb about your book that you had a heart attack while you were on active duty.
Yeah, it's the craziest thing. I've been in command for about 2.5 years, and I got selected in the late fall to sit on a promotion board in Quantico. And, of course, my successor had already been named. I knew when I came back from the board, it was time to start getting the command ready for turnover and dotting I's, crossing T's, all those kinds of things. And I was headed out to the board, and it was a Saturday morning, and Melissa was, my wife, was taking me to the airport. And when I was going, you know, I just didn't feel so good that morning. I had a big breakfast. I really just thought I had indigestion, quite frankly. And so as she is taking me to the airport, she says, you know, you really ought to stop by and stop by the doctor. And, of course, like any good Marine, no, I'm fine. I'll be okay. And so we stopped, got a little bottle of Maalox. I took a couple of big swigs, and, you know, we headed on to the airport. And I just really wasn't feeling any better. And then, of course, she played the punk card, and she says, you know, all your friends are on the board. Your guys are going to be sequestered for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. You don't want to make everybody sick. And, you know, with that, she whips off the interstate and pulls right into the ER, which was literally, you could see it from the interstate. And I go in, and I'm thinking, you know, here we are. We're in the Fort Worth ER early on a Saturday morning. There is no way we're going to get in. You know, you've got all these cowboys that need to be stitched up from a fun Friday night. And then I thought, well, this might be my early exit. I can go in there. They'll be crowded. I'll have to leave to get my plane. Well, you know, I go in there, and there is not a soul in the waiting room. Imagine that. So they take me back. They triage me, and I'm sitting back in the waiting room. Melissa's back there with me, and I am just looking at my watch thinking, we've got to go. This is crazy. And the doctor comes in there and bursts the door open. A couple of nurses follow and say, you're having a heart attack. I'm like, you got to be crazy, don't you? You know, and of course, your mind slows down, and things are going through your mind like crazy at the same time. And I'm thinking, there's got to be some old guy, you know, in a room next door that's really in a bad situation, and he needs you guys, and here you are in here, you know, messing around with me. Well, you know, the doctor was right, and I was wrong. No joke. I was having a heart attack, and I didn't really know it. I didn't feel that bad. I just knew something was not right. But, man, that was an eye-opener.
And how old were you, Ted?
Gosh, I was 47. I had just turned 47. I just completed my combat fitness test. I had a perfect score on it. I felt like I was in great shape, but, you know, something malfunctioned. I mean, literally, I just completed the CFT the week prior.
You know, again, that's not a, you know, fit, you know, but on the inside, maybe not as healthy as outwardly fit, maybe not as healthy as we ought to be. How does that impact? Does that impact your decision to retire? Had you already decided you were going to retire? What next?
You know, it's kind of funny, Mac. It's interesting. Melissa and I had talked about it and thought, you know, if I was ever going to retire, that this was a perfect time. Our daughter was on her way to college. Our son was going from the 8th to 9th grade. And, you know, we had been to 3 high schools with Alexis in 3 years, Washington, D.C., Southern California, and then Texas.
Right.
And, you know, having a teenager go to 3 schools, 3 years, that's tough. And we thought, you know, maybe we ought to just call it and give Ward the opportunity to go to one school and maybe just get out. It's a perfect time to do it. And as we talked, we really realized that that's not really what we wanted to do. The kids were on board with staying in the Marine Corps, and at the end of the day, I just really wasn't ready to do it. And we had decided to stay in and to go forward, and was already working on my next set of orders, which ironically was back to Afghanistan, exactly what I wanted to do. So we'd been through this soul searching for a couple of months, you know, before I had the heart attack. And then so you go on this crazy roller coaster ride from making the decision, let's just continue to push this Marine Corps thing as far as it will go. And then, boom, you have that heart attack. You know, I didn't really wait to see if I would be med boarded or anything like that. I didn't want to go through that. And it was a pretty easy decision. I didn't want to be some fat old colonel sitting behind a desk waiting for a board, et cetera. And I knew if I couldn't do those things that Marines did 110%, it was time to go. But the real lesson for me, Mac, is I did not have a plan. I did not have a backup plan at all. And I can tell you, when you go and you start talking to people in corporate America and they ask, what do you want to do? And you look at them and say, I want to be in charge. That is not a job description. As much as we may think we can do anything or run anything, and I think we can. But that is not a job description that people are going to hire you into.
Talk to me about, before we transition to you in the corporate world, your combat experiences. What years, where were you at? What did you do?
You know, I was a platoon commander in the first Gulf War.
Okay.
And, you know, I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
What unit? Who are you with?
It was with Bravo 112.
Okay.
And so, you know, that made a huge impression really on the rest of my career. Just seeing what the Marines do, what the Marines did in those circumstances, and how people acquitted themselves, doing the right thing, making decisions, you know, and there are no rules. You're just out there doing the best that you can in the middle of chaos. And it just really, really made me proud of being a Marine and seeing what young people can absolutely do. And, you know, it's great when you, I'm sure you've read the book, Tom Ricks, Making the Core. And he talks about young Marines going ashore in Somalia. And he basically says, you know, my life is in the hands of these young Marines. And here back at the Wall Street Journal, these guys wouldn't even be allowed to use a copy machine. But here we are, these 20-year-olds are leading Marines in combat. They're making decisions. And you realize what a phenomenal pool of talent we have as our young people that are Marines. So that was my big takeaway from the first Gulf War. And then I go and my next combat tour is in Afghanistan as operations officer for the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force.
What year?
That was in 2010. And I think when you got to Afghanistan was about the point that I was leaving in the summer of 2010.
We got there a little bit after that. I got there in September or late August, early September, so we just missed each other.
Yeah.
Give me a takeaway from that.
You know, there are a number of takeaways, but the first thing I remember, a guy I served with at the basic school. At the time, it was Colonel Paul Kennedy, now Major General Kennedy. And I know you know him well.
Yeah, he's a buddy.
But it was one just really terribly windy, just a bad night. And he had some Marines that were engaged with the Taliban in a very bad area, Musakala. And the fight had gone through the day, and it was going into the night, and really was, you know, at a decision point. And he had been out with some of his other Marines, and he stopped by the CP on his way back, and we were following the fight. And he came in, and we started talking about, you know, what do? Do we press the fight, et cetera? And he picks up the phone, and he calls his Marines. He says, what do you guys want to do? And makes a decision right there, let's press the fight. And long story short, the fight continues through the night. We execute a resupply. The aviation community does some heroic work to evacuate wounded Marines, to get in this resupply, and keep pressing the Taliban to push them out of this hotly contested area that, as you know, had gone back and forth with the Brits for years.
Right.
In this historic place. But the leadership to look at the guy who's at the pointy end of the spear and say, what do you want to do? I trust you. I trained you. Make a decision, and I'm going to support you 110%. You know, that's leadership 101, and that's applicable to any and every endeavor, whether it's in corporate America, whether it's in combat, whether it's in garrison. You train somebody, you trust them, and you back them 110%. And it was leadership 101. It was a beautiful thing.
When you get out, what did you want to do? What did you have anything in mind? You'd have some pretty you know, some pretty good tickets to get punched. You know, first of all, service forward during a time of war, that always, you know, people, I think, find that interesting. Recruiting is running your own business out there. The basic school education, you had a whole lot of ways to go. What did you feel like you wanted to do?
You know, and that's my first lesson. I did not have a backup plan. And I say that, and not trying to be trite, I really never thought about it. I really and truly thought I can do anything. Just give me a group, and we'll figure it out. We can make it happen. Just like we do, whether you're on recruiting duty, whether you're in combat, whether you're in the Pentagon, we learn to figure it out quickly and then move an organization forward.
Well, let me ask you now. You had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Do you think that the situation you found yourself in, I mean, that's pretty typical for most, you know, guys and, you know, for most, you know, guys and girls in the military, is that, you know, you had your future in front of you. You hadn't got to that time and say, okay, well, you know what, I am going to get out. You know, we'll do that in a year. I'll take the next year to figure it out. You know, I think that would be the way that most people would see this happening. So, I mean, I don't think you were that atypical of people that, how do I say it, of people that that find themselves in the situation that you found yourself in.
You know, Mac, I talk to veterans literally every week.
Right.
And so many are just like me. You know, I'll figure it out when I retire, when I EAS, whatever that case may be. And people want to hire veterans. But as you need to know what you want to do. Do I want to be in operations? Do I want to be in logistics? Do I want to be in IT? Do I want to be with a startup or, you know, a large Fortune 50 company? Whatever that case may be. And it's something that I had never really thought about until, you know, I was faced with that decision. And that's the first thing when I talk to guys. I say, you know, you need to take a little time to think along the way. And think about what would you do if everything changed today? What are your interests? And really, what would suit you and your family? And there's no perfect answer. But it's something you really need to take the time to consider.
So what did you decide?
Well, you know, I was looking at several different options. I talked to a railroad. I talked to a large bank in New York about being an international banker. I looked at the insurance business. And this Home Depot thing kept popping up. I had a mentor through American Corporate Partners who was helping me with the resume and helping me with interview skills, et cetera. And he asked me, he said, Ted, have you ever thought about Home Depot? And I thought, absolutely not. You know, I'm not a handyman. We lived on base. If there was anything wrong, we called base maintenance. And most of the time I was gone, and Melissa fixed anything that was broken. And I think a lot of guys can relate to that. And he said, no, that's not what we're looking for. I'm looking for leadership. And he said, would you be interested? And so, you know, I said, yes, I am. But really, I didn't know anything about retail or that, you know, the home improvement business. But what drew me to Home Depot was the values. And I think I kind of bumbled into this. But if I had to start looking for a job today, I would base it off of values. And I saw in Home Depot that they had values, taking care of people, doing the right thing, an entrepreneurial spirit. And that struck me. It was really, although it was an honor, courage, and commitment, it was talking about doing the right thing when nobody was looking. And I thought, you know, here's a company that has these values. And as I did my research, I saw the company lived up to those values. And as I spent time with people in Home Depot, as I was, you know, doing my research and talking to people in the company and doing some of the interviews, I realized that although no organization is perfect, they had a touchstone just like we did in the Marine Corps. So I made my decision based off the values. And I thought, you know, I'll figure this out. I feel pretty confident that I can do anything. Just give me a chance with a good team, and we'll make it happen from there. And it has turned out to be a wonderful decision.
Talk to me about how you discovered the values of Home Depot. How did that, was that stuff you explored online, you talked to people? How do you find out what a company is really about, what their soul's about?
You know, I think, Mac, I bumbled into it. I will make no pretense about it. I was literally rehearsing for an interview with my mentor at Home Depot. I was looking to take this banking job in Manhattan. And I saw their value wheel literally painted on the wall behind the guy that I was talking to. And he had to get up to take a phone call. And I looked at it when he got up, and I thought, wow, this really strikes me. But if I were looking for a job today, if I were talking to guys, which I do every week, go on the website and look and see what those values are. But more importantly, see what the company is doing. You know, everybody can write a value statement. You know, you take 10 minutes and throw some nice words. But really, what are they doing in that space that they talk about? If they're talking about doing things for veterans, what are they doing for veterans? And all of this is open on the internet. You can find it readily. And then I would talk to people in the organization and see what they think, A, about the organization, and B, do they think the organization is living up to its values? And the organizations that I have found that really do live up to those values, their associates, their employees are more than happy to talk to you about it. In fact, they want you to talk about it because they're proud of it. Just like we were proud of being Marines. Right. We didn't talk about our MOS. We talk about being Marines. And you find the same in corporate America.
Well, unless you're inside the Marine Corps, then we talk about our MOS, because everybody got to know who's in charge, and we all know the grunts are. So Ted, you take us through your career at Home Depot. And what did you start? And then are you still there? Have you retired?
Yeah, I'm still with Home Depot. And you know, this is one of the things, again, I just really bumbled into this. I wish I could tell you I had this grand plan. I really didn't. But going with Home Depot's a Fortune 25 company, it gives you a lot of opportunities to explore and do different things in the company. And I'll give you an illustration. I started off in the stores as a co-manager. So we're running, me and another guy, this store that had a $60 million sales plan every year. So you're running a pretty significant business. And I knew I needed to learn the business, I needed to learn the culture, and I needed to learn the people. So this gave me the opportunity to really learn at the point in the sphere. It's like being a platoon commander.
Right.
And then from there, that opened doors for me to be able to teach leadership at Home Depot University. And you know, being a teacher at the basic school, that's a dream come true.
Right.
So I was able to do that for a couple of years, and then Home Depot opened up a new role, and it was a staffing role, and I was the first guy to fill it. And so I was responsible for staffing for the western third of the country for our merchandising organization. So it's really recruiting 101. I was running a recruiting organization for Home Depot. And then, so, you know, that felt pretty natural. And then I'm in another brand new role for Home Depot, and I run operations for our business-to-business operations team. And so that is for our big businesses that do business with Home Depot outside the Home Depot stores. I work in that part of our business. So, you know, being with a Fortune 25 company, it allows you to explore a lot of different things. And you know, as Marines, we do a job for a year or two, and then we move on to the next challenge. And I really enjoyed having the different challenges in Home Depot. You never get bored that way. You're always learning.
My guest today is Tim Studdard, retired Marine, and retired as a colonel, lieutenant colonel?
Yeah, as a colonel.
Well, a senator from the Marine Corps. And he's written a book called Depot to Depot. Again, I didn't mean to insult you by calling you a senator, but there was a time in our nation's history when that was an august title, and hence our colonels are tagged with it. He's written a book called Depot to Depot, A Transformational Leadership Journey from the Military to Corporate America. So let's talk about the book. What makes you decide that you want to write a book?
You know, I came back from Afghanistan, and being on recruiting duty, I had the opportunity to literally speak all around the country. And as I would talk to leaders and civic organizations and educators, I realized that people really didn't understand what we did as Marines, or really what we did as service members writ large. And I really didn't think that much about it, quite frankly, until after I got out of the Marine Corps. And now I'm in Home Depot, and I serve on the board of directors for our military appreciation group. And as such, again, I had the opportunity to literally speak all over the country to veterans organizations, athletes, and corporate audiences. And it really dawned on me that corporate America, as I had a chance to really touch a lot of different businesses, I started hearing the same thing. Corporate America loves our veterans, but doesn't really know what to do with our veterans because corporate America doesn't understand what the veterans have done. And I'll give you an example. I was on my way to talk to the Student Veterans of America. And as I'm leaving and headed to the airport, I've got one of our senior leaders that comes up, and she puts her arm on my her hand on my shoulder. She says, "Ted, please make sure you tell these young people in corporate America they have to think." Now, you can imagine, I was about ready to explode. But I realized that she didn't mean anything negative. It certainly wasn't a dig. She didn't understand. She didn't know any better. She didn't realize the magnitude of what these young people, our young veterans, have done in combat, out of combat, what their responsibility is. And that really crystallized it for me, that we're like two ships passing in the dark. Veterans want and need and can add to our economy in corporate America, and corporate America wants and needs our veterans, but we're not connecting. So often corporate America and people who are hiring think if you're a service member, you're either Forrest Gump, just tell me what to do and I'll do it, or you're some crazed drill instructor yelling, screaming, spitting on people, just a lunatic. And as we all know, neither of those is correct. But if you haven't served or you don't have a close relative that served to really see what it's all about, you don't know. And so Hollywood has painted a picture for so many people that are responsible for talent acquisition. So I realized I'd given a speech in Kansas City to a group of NFL athletes and military guys. And after the speech, one of the guys said, "You really ought to write a book about this." And so all this happened about the same time. I thought, you know, you're right. I really need to. And so I embarked on this journey to write a book to help corporate America understand the experiences that our veterans have had and what they have to offer corporate America, and also to help our veterans understand what that transition is like and ultimately the transformation that they will have to go through as they exit the service and re-enter the civilian world and hopefully go into corporate America or at least explore those options. And lastly, as any book about Marines, of course, it's got a leadership element to it as well.
All right. Let's talk about the book. How did you write the book? What does it walk you through in terms of if I were to go out and purchase it online right now? Tell everybody how you walk them through that journey.
You know, Mac, what I wanted to do was illustrate any veteran so that if I were a hiring manager or somebody in talent acquisition or a leader in corporate America, I could pick this book up and I could see through a series of stories an illustration on what my veterans would have to offer corporate America. And I really struggled. How do you describe that? And I thought, how do I do it? You know, I'm just a Marine. I'm not anything special. Nobody cares about Ted Studdard, nor should they.
And besides that, you're an arty guy. So, I mean,
yeah,
come on.
Just scum of the earth here.
Well, not scum. It's not like you got out of the air defense community, so you at least were respectable. But come on, really.
Yeah, you know, I was just waiting. I wondered how long it was going to take before I got to dig.
Well, come on. You know, I can't be that nice. You know, what the hell?
Oh, gosh. But, you know, I realized as I was thinking through this, I was so fortunate to serve with just some incredible leaders. So what I decided to do is take a little different tack, not to talk about Ted Studdard, but to talk about the leaders and the things that I experienced really at each rank through that journey from private through colonel. And I was fortunate to serve with some incredible leaders. So what I try to do is illustrate some sort of leadership lesson or something that anybody, you could fill in, you could just fill in the blank. It doesn't have to be Ted Studdard. You could fill in your name. You could fill in thousands of names in here who had very similar experiences. And so that's what it is talking about the leadership lessons learned and experiences at each rank that that we've all had. That if I were leading or running a large company or any company, I could look at this book, I could read it and say, wow, I would love to have a guy that's got those intangibles. Love to have a guy or a gal who's had those experiences. I can teach them what I'm doing, but if I have got that experience, man, we can rock whatever we're doing in the business world. So that's really what the book is. The first part of that book is that leadership journey to illustrate to corporate America what guys like us have to offer. And then as it transitions from the heart attack and it follows me into corporate America, that's for guys like you and I to understand what that's like. Because most of us don't really fully grasp what it's like to make that move. And I talk to veterans all the time, and they think they're just going to rocket right into corporate America. And some really do. But most guys have got to take a step back to take a step forward. And when I say that, you're entering in a whole new world. And I came home, I'll give you a story to illustrate this. I came home one night, and I was just wringing my hands, and Melissa said, what is wrong with you? And I've been with Home Depot for about 3 months at this point. I said, sweetheart, I'm not sure I can do this. And she looked at me, and she said, what do you mean? And I thought I might get a bit of sympathy, but as you know, that was not coming. She just looked at me. She said, what do you mean? You chose to do this. It's a great job with a great company. I mean, what could possibly be wrong? I said, sweetheart, think back. 25 years ago, I had more Marines in my first platoon. I took these guys to combat. We came back together. I had more responsibility, more authority, more autonomy than I do now 25 years later in Home Depot. And she looked at me, she said, okay. And she said, let me ask you a question. Would you take an executive out of Home Depot today and put them in your role in Afghanistan? And I looked at her. At this point, I'd met some phenomenal leaders, and I knew they had those intangible leadership qualities, and some of the guys could have done that.
That's right.
But I looked at her, I said, no. And she said, why not? I said, because they don't have the depth of experience or the breadth of knowledge to step in there and do that role and to do it efficiently and effectively right off the bat. And she looked at me and she said, there's your answer. And I knew when she said that that she was absolutely correct. And any of us, when we're getting out of the service, unless we're going into a technical specialty that we did in the service, and most of us don't, most right. of us are generalists, we're going to have to take a little step back. But when we take that step back, and we take a minute, we listen, and we learn, doors are going to open. And doors are going to continue to open. And you're just going to move forward, and you're going to move forward quickly. But sometimes you got to take that step back in order to take a step forward. And that's what the second part of the book is about, helping guys understand that that's part of that transition and ultimately the transformation that they're going to have to make.
Taking a step back to take a step forward. I interviewed a guy, I think his name's Colby Williamson. He was a fire team leader in Fallujah in 2004. I can't remember which version of Fallujah that he was involved in. And I think maybe the second. And he talked about thinking of when you get out that you're going to have to do one, maybe two more deployments or maybe two more duty station assignments to get the experience that you need to ultimately get the job that you want. And I thought that was an interesting way, and I'd be curious for you to comment on that. I thought that was an interesting way because, you know, you come out of the, everybody gets out of the military, and you're looking around, what do I do, where do I go, where do I fit? But at the same time, right? We have families, and if you're younger, you have kids. And so there's a logistical factor, a financial factor, that not too many of us get out and don't have to worry about money. And so, like, yeah, I want you to be happy, and I want you to look around, but we have a beast to feed in this family that, you know, that runs up expenses all the time. So I'm curious about what you think of that. I thought it was pretty sage advice, because and one of the rationales he gave for it, he said, look, you got to go where somebody will hire you so you can get the experience. He said, if you want to pin yourself into one geographic area, he said, what some people do, you know, it may take you longer to get your career going because, you know, you can't start where you want to start. And he said, for instance, he said, I went to Minneapolis, St. Paul, which is, you know, has Best Buy, has Target. So it was right, and they're looking for young people in the corporate world. He said, but if I go to Los Angeles, if I go to D.C., he said, it's a lot harder there because you have people from all over the country that will go to those places, most of them with more experience than you. He said, so you have to have an eye for that. And then he said, and then you're looking to get the experience you need, so then you can be most qualified and go compete. He said, because he said, Marines, people want to hire you. The skills we have, but you got to be able to get into the hiring basket. And a lot of people are eliminated simply, you know, because they can't pass the keyword screening and the computer stuff that they do. I'm curious, is that valid, not valid?
I think it's absolutely valid. And let me just touch on the last piece of this that you said, you know, you don't pass that computer screen. So having worked in the talent acquisition, again, for a Fortune 25 company, kind of been able to, you know, pull the curtain back and seeing the little fat man we call the Wizard of Oz behind that curtain, a lot of the people who are the gatekeepers are young guys and gals right out of college who have very limited experience. And I'll give you Home Depot. We had over 1 million people that applied for Home Depot last year. So these guys and gals they've got a kind of a quota to meet, and they are trying to put faces in spaces. And when you get 1 million resumes, you have to, you know, ferret some of those out pretty quickly. And so you start looking at these keywords, et cetera, et cetera. And I have talked to a lot of guys who get very frustrated because they send in resumes and they never get a call back. And just a side note, you're not going to get a call back from a major company. They just don't have the time to do it. And you can argue and say how wrong that is. That's just a fact. And so don't get upset with it. Just accept it. But really, and it really rubbed me the wrong way when I first heard it. You know, you got to network. And I just had this vision of, you know, I'm just running around kissing somebody's rear end for a job. And I just was not going to do that. But I realized, and having seen that, networking is the way you're going to get your job. If you have somebody in that company that you know and that can help pull you through that screening process, your opportunity to get hired goes up exponentially. It means a lot. And the time, you know, so many guys just focus on the resume. Get your resume, do it. You know, a resume is a resume. Make sure it's factual, make sure it's accurate, make sure it looks good, and then put it down and start networking. Meet people in the industry, meet people in the company that you are interested in. Go have coffee with them. Talk to them. Go visit them at work. That's the way you're going to get the job.
Okay, let me ask you. I'm a son who just got out this year. And yeah. I'll say, well, here's let me pause, all right? So I'm going to ask you a question about resumes. Okay,
yeah.
But I'll come back to that. I do a fair amount of public speaking with this thing that I call post-traumatic winning. And one of the things I say to everybody is how unique our DNA is, that the people that go through door number 4, we reject 3 other services to join the one that's most challenging to get into. And the chip on our shoulder, the desire to do better, the desire to be tougher and harder is, you know, is a quintessentially a Marine, you know, quality. And the corporation, as you know, Ted, when you go forward and you see Marines get ready to fight, I don't care, and you can tell me I'm biased, but there's nobody who fights like Marines. And it's because of what comes through the door. The DNA that looks at an advertisement and says, maybe you could be one of us. Maybe. The people that look at that and go, I'll try that. And then they see the videos of recruit training. That's crazy. And you're not from that culture and you've never been there. And you say, yeah, I'll do that. That's a different kid. Now, and one of the things I say is this whole victim, this veteran victim narrative about how hard it is to, you know, veteran unemployment and all this bullshit, in my opinion, if you work half as hard at getting out as you do getting in, you will be so successful, it'll be a joke. But nobody's going to come and door kick your home and yank you off the couch to go give you a job. To me, this whole veteran victim thing is, it bugs me because it ain't us. But you read it all the time. Oh, veterans. Oh, they need help. I look at them and say, if you work half as hard to get out of this thing as you did to get in, not only will you not have an issue, you wind up doing great. And I know this because my younger son, of my two sons, you know, he worked hard at getting out and got a job with KPMG and doing good. That's his first job out of the Marine Corps. And so I'm curious about your thoughts about veteran victimhood and working hard to do this as opposed to, you know, thinking that somebody's going to come invite you off the couch and give you a job.
Mac, you're spot on. The majority of veterans that I talk with are willing to get after it. And the Marines especially, I think you nailed it. Our DNA is different. And that's what makes us who we are. It was interesting. I was in San Diego a couple of weeks ago talking to a group of veterans. And I had one guy, he was a little bit older than I am, kind of down on his luck. And he kept saying, nobody's giving me anything because I'm a veteran. I deserve something. You don't deserve jack. You know, if we have that victim mentality and we want free government cheese, that's not what it's about. And you absolutely nailed it. When we have to make that transition, we all are, out of the service and then transform into whatever, whether it's corporate America, but we have to transform back into the civilian community. We have to be adaptable and we have to work hard and we have to realize that we don't deserve or rate anything just because we're a veteran. We chose to do that. And the minute that we think we're special, the minute that we think that people owe us, we're headed in the wrong direction, I think.
Interesting. All right, now I want to go back to resumes. You have people that put so much stock in resumes, and they spend months and months and months on the resume, and you just kind of said, don't do that. Explain, because again, I'm sure, you know, in tech class, they give you all these different things and you hear different things from different people that are already out in the corporate world. Talk to me about if you were to spend time today, and I want you to give me percentages, and I'm only going to give you two choices. You can spend time on networking or you can spend time on your resume, a portion 100% of the time between only those two things.
75 on networking. You know what? 85 networking, 15 resume.
Got it. All right. I want people to hear that because you hear so many different things in transition classes and you see people doing that. Next question. Would you hire somebody to do your resume?
No. And Mac, that was probably the most painful thing. Just stick a pencil in your eye while you're trying to do a resume. And I really thought about hiring somebody to do that. And I had a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel. He said, don't do it. He said, the effort that you put in your resume is worth it because then you know it. It's in your words. And the resume is just there to help you tell a story. And what you put on that resume, it's got to be you. And I think that was very, very good advice. All the blood, sweat, and tears you put into it, make it all worthwhile. And you, nobody will ever do it justice the way you will.
Got it. Okay, let me ask you, I've got another question about, and this is for older people. I got told when I got ready to get out, and I thought that instead of starting this business, I thought I might go work for somebody. And then the therapist I was seeing at the time said, you might not want to go do that. I said, why? He said, I don't think you'd do well, you know, with somebody who wasn't. He said, let me be direct. I don't think you're going to do well working for a Marine, you know. I'm telling you, not working for a Marine, somebody who you respect. I said, really? And he said, yeah. I said, And so then I started pinging guys who'd already gotten out. And I'd say, any advice? And I was surprised at this. I got told by probably a half dozen guys that I know, don't mention your combat experiences at all. Because the corporate world, not the corporate world, people that run HR departments, people who interview people, if they're not Marines or in the military, they don't know what you're talking about. All they know is what they read. And so you talking about you were in Fallujah, you know, during the height of the fighting, or Ramadi or Helmand or wherever the hell you were, may not play well in Peoria. I'd be curious your thoughts on that.
You know, I think there's a lot of wisdom in what you're saying to a degree. I don't think you don't talk about it. You think about the incredible things that our young people have done, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, the decisions, the stress, the pressure. That's why I would want to hire you, because of what you have been through. That's what makes you special. But I wouldn't dwell on it. You don't need to go into an interview and talk about war stories. You don't need to talk about, you know, how tough it was. I was there, you know, I was faced with some tough decisions. I made decisions and we moved on. That's all you need to do. Don't dwell on it. But I don't think you run away from it either.
All right. So let me ask you specifically. Let me ask you a follow up on that. So if I'm interviewing you and I'm looking at your resume, and I read operations officer, Ramadi, 2006, for, you know, 1st Battalion, 11th Marines. And I look at you and I say, tell me about being the operations officer, doing operations in during the war. What was that like? Give me an answer that you would give.
You know, it was a high-stress, high-paced environment, and I had to learn to be able to think objectively. I had to learn to think and make decisions without 100% clarity and to be comfortable making those decisions. I had to be organized, and I had to be calm despite the chaos going on around me. And it's really helped me to be able to think through problems and solve problems, not only effectively, but quickly and effectively. And as you can imagine, you're probably not going to put stress on me that will ever equate to what I've been through. So I can handle anything you throw out at me.
All right. Very good. The talk to me about as you start out in, you know, most of us have been leaders most of our lives. And now you do go into the corporate world, you know, in their eyes as a junior leader. Some people struggle with that. How did you handle it?
It's tough. It really is. And what I had to, I think I was fortunate. And I'll tell you, as you know, as we get to be more senior in the Marine Corps, you've got your young lieutenants and your young NCOs and staff NCOs, and you realize what smart kids these guys are, what smart young people they are, how talented they are. And, you know, we all learn from our Marines. And so keeping that perspective, going into corporate America, knowing that these guys knew things I did not know, helped me. You just have to swallow your pride sometimes and say, teach me. And I think having been on recruiting duty probably helped me more than anything, because, you know, you go out there as a major, you've got all your young sergeants, staff sergeants, gunnies out there. They know far more than you do. And you have to, you literally have to learn. You have to trust them to teach you. And I think that experience probably helped me more than anything in corporate America. Because, yeah, I can lead any organization, but there's some things I needed to learn. And I think having been on recruiting duty and really having to learn something I didn't know anything about prepared me way better than I thought it did.
So you have to do, you're going to have to, you know, kind of go there and reprove yourself. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to walk in there and you're not going to, you're not going to wow them and take the place over on day one. You're going to have to probably take a back seat. You're going to have to prove yourself. And so just be patient, prove yourself, and don't overplay the hand of all your experience.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you have to, it's the OODA loop. It really is. You have to listen. You have to learn. And really, people don't care about your stories. You know, you'll have people that will ask you and they're curious, but for the most part, they don't care how you did it in, you know, 11th Marines. They don't care how you did it in 5th Marines. They want to know what you are doing now. So you're taking those experiences from the Marine Corps. You just don't need to advertise to everybody. Let me tell you how we did it in the Marine Corps and how jacked up you are. You have to realize corporate America has been pretty successful without us, you know, without that individual Marine joining the company. They're going to be just fine without that individual Marine. But they will be much better with that Marine. But you just have to take the time to let it mature and show what you can do. Don't tell everybody. Just do it.
Got it. Have you found that sometimes the Marine Corps is intimidating to people, that when people found out that, oh, yeah, he used to be a Marine, was that a barrier that you had to overcome sometimes? Because sometimes that can be intimidating and people assume certain things about you, whether they believe you're, you know, Lee Ermey, you know, or, you know, Gunny Highway or some other character they've seen on Major Dad or some of the nonsense that goes along. Is that sometimes something you have to overcome?
Yeah, you know, it absolutely is. I've had people that I work for come and say, I'm scared to death. I don't really know what to do with you. Like, hey, I'm your friendly neighborhood Marine. But just like you say, they've got this perception. And I think you have to be calm, cool, and collect. They're just waiting for you to explode sometimes. And when they realize that that's not the way we operate, and that is not how we are wired, they tend to relax. But initially, I think you do face that a lot, especially with our young Marines, our younger Marines coming straight, you know, straight from the fleet into corporate America. And I think some of your senior leaders are quite intimidated. I've had some very senior leaders that have come to me and said, hey, help me as a leader. I'm struggling. Help me. And I take that as something that's very precious. When somebody asks you for help, what a humbling thing that is. And you have a great opportunity to really put your stamp, the Marine Corps stamp, on your organization. But you have to have a degree of humility to go along with it.
Does caring about people and helping people, you know, just like most of us have done most of our careers, have been good leaders, is that any different than the corporate world than it is in the Marine Corps?
You know, it is not. Leading people and taking care of people and doing the right thing is universal. What I found, and I didn't fully appreciate this in the Marine Corps, rank at every school, everything we did had it. Literally, if you're a Marine, you've got a PhD in leadership, whether you realize it or not. So now in corporate America, you realize that nobody's teaching leadership. You don't have the sergeant major or the first sergeant giving you a 10-minute leadership PME every week. You don't have the captain pulling you aside and saying, hey, Lieutenant, let me share a story with you. You don't have Major Mike Etor, when I was teaching at the basic school, bringing all the captains in and say, hey, boys, let me tell you what it's going to be like when you're company commanders.
Well, Mike Etor's got a pretty decent business now running a basic school on his own for corporate America.
He does indeed. In fact, I write about him in Depot to Depot, a very influential leader. But you get so caught up in the day-to-day business that sometimes we forget that people aren't born to be leaders. You have to nurture, you have to grow, you have to teach. And I think that's something that's part of our DNA that you don't see in corporate America. And I have talked to Fortune 50 companies all across America, and I hear the same thing. We just don't take the time to teach leadership. And leadership is really just taking care of people.
Right.
And you might want to do it, but you just don't have the tools or know how to do it because you've never been taught. And I think it's a great opportunity where Marines especially can make a huge impact in corporate America.
Got it. All right. Tell me, in this hour that we spent together, tell me, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about your book that you want to make sure people know?
Well, you know, first off, what's going on with the book? And I'd like to tell you, I was very fortunate in writing this book because I told you there are some tremendous leaders who took the time to help me growing up and going through the Marine Corps. And it's really an opportunity to give back. So everything from this book is going to help veterans in transition and to help Marines through the Marine Corps University Foundation. So American Corporate Partners, Our Heroes USA, and the Marine Corps University Foundation, they're the recipients of all the funds from this book. Yeah. So it's going back. It's kind of paying it forward as people have helped you and I along the way. This is our opportunity to help them. Please go buy the book. I think it's a great tool, but more importantly, it goes to a great cause. You mentioned something earlier, and I would like to share something with you and your audience that I wrote another book. It's an e-book. It's 14 pages. It's a little electronic workbook about transition. It's free. If you go to my website, tedstuttard.com, and you go under books, you can click on the link. It's called Take Time to Think. And it goes through those very things that you were talking about, Mac. What are those decisions I need to make when I get out? What do my finances look like? What are my values? What does my family need? Where do we want to live? What company do I want to be part of, et cetera? If you'll take the time to think before you write your resume, if you'll take the time to think before you embark on this next journey and do your planning, everything else will fall into line a lot smoother. So I would highly encourage you, if you're transitioning, which we all are at some point, go download this little workbook, sit down with your family, go through it. I guarantee it will help that transition go a lot better.
All right. And you'll find that link in the podcast portion. So when you're listening to this, if you just scroll down the page of what you clicked on, so you might have to go back, you'll find that link to that little kind of operational planning guide in this podcast itself. What else haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you were? That's a trick question, by the way. You're supposed to say nothing, Mac. This is awesome. The way to screw that one up. See? And you wonder why people hate arty guys. So what else haven't I been smart enough to ask you?
Oh, my gosh. You know, that's just as low-hanging fruit. I probably ought not to touch that on radio right now. Mac, I just want to tell you thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for what you're doing through your radio show, your podcast. And, you know, you're paying it forward, man. Thank you for everything that you're doing. Thank you for allowing me to get out and hopefully share some information that will help some other guys be successful as they continue their journey through life.
No, you know, Ted, I'll tell you what, I mean, I love talking about this stuff because everybody goes through it, and it's not easy, and people hear so much from so many different ways, and I know sometimes people get confused, and so to have somebody who's on the far side, who can counsel up from down is a huge resource, and I hope in the future you don't mind when I have questions that I give you a call that I can go ahead and bring you back on and we'll talk about those things.
Man, I would love to, and guys can always reach out to me on LinkedIn and any of the social media sites. I'm there. If I can ever help anybody, just let me know.
All right. In fact, let's do that. Why don't give everybody, spell your last name, because I think, in fact, I even did it. I went and looked up Stoddard, right? But it ain't spelled like that, right?
There you go. It's Ted, T-E-D, and last name is Stoddard, S-T-U-D-D-A-R-D.
And they can find you on LinkedIn like that?
Yeah, Ted Stoddard on LinkedIn. You can find me on the social media that same way, Twitter, Instagram, all that. But LinkedIn is probably the best. And, of course, I've got the website, tedstuttered.com.
Got it. All right. And so if they're just looking for – somebody just looking for advice and say, hey, I've heard this and I've heard this, do you have any feelings? You don't mind answering those questions?
Absolutely not. I would love to.
All right. Well, first of all, congratulations on not only a great Marine Corps career, but a great second career with a great company that's founded by – Home Depot, though, has a lot of military guys working for it, right?
You know, Home Depot does some incredible things. In fact, the company's given over $250 million away to veterans' causes, specifically veterans' housing, and has pledged another $250 million. So, you know, when you talk about a company with values, I can say from the bottom of my heart that, our company, Home Depot, is living those values, is putting its money where its mouth is.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And the when you investigated, if you don't mind me asking, when you investigated about the culture of Home Depot, how did you do that? Did you talk to Home Depot people there, veterans that worked there? Where did you find the best information that you got?
Well, let me tie this back into networking. So When I met with my ACP mentor, who was an executive at Home Depot, you know, I told you the story. I saw the Home Depot value wheel on the wall.
Right.
He said, well, let me introduce you to some people at Home Depot, and you can just have some discussions. Well, I didn't really realize it, but I spent the next 2 months networking nearly every week with somebody in Home Depot across the country. And not only that, it kind of went up the pecking order, and I started out at a kind of a low level of who I was talking to. I say a low level, it's probably the wrong terminology, but, you know, junior leaders. And the last person I talked to was literally the division president. And I didn't fully appreciate that every one of those conversations was networking. It was also an interview. They were interviewing me, but I was really also interviewing them. I'd seen these values on the wall. But as I would go into Home Depot offices, I would go into Home Depot stores, you're looking to see if people are really living those values. And, of course, you're seeing the things on the Internet, et cetera. And so that's how, through networking, I really got to see behind the scenes at Home Depot. I'd go in and spend a few hours in Home Depot, and I saw it in action. And I would highly recommend that to people who are looking for a company to join. Go spend time with them. They will love to have you do a ride-along. Most people are going to say, absolutely, come spend a day at work with me. They'll love to show you what they're doing. And that's how you really find out as a company living its values.
All right. Tell everybody where they find your book, Ted.
Okay. You can find my book at my website, tedstuttered.com. You can also go on Amazon, type in Ted Stoddard, Depot to Depot. You can also get it at Barnes & Noble. Again, type in Ted Stoddard, Depot to Depot.
Did you self-publish your book?
You know, I did not. I went through a publishing company, Kohler Publishing, and I know a lot of guys do it on their own, but I knew what my capability set was, and I needed some help. So I was very fortunate to find a publisher, and I'm glad I did. They really helped guide me through the process. And I didn't know what I didn't know. And I know that sounds kind of funny to say that, but I knew I wanted to write a book. I kind of had an idea of some of the content. but I had no idea on how to do it. And they were very helpful.
Interesting. All right, sir. First of all, Mike Marletto put us in touch, so we both have him to thank for this. But congratulations on all your success and well done in terms of the proceeds of your book going to help our tribe and our community. So and then thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Mac. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you.
There you have it. Ted Studdard, he's a Hawk Missile guy and an Artie guy. He's right here talking about his book, Depot to Depot. More Ball Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. How about that? Studdard. I enjoyed the conversation. He's a good guy. And, who knows? Maybe we can do some work together in the future as post-traumatic winning expands its reach. It's always great to work with guys that get it, and Ted gets it, so he's a good guy. That'll do it. If you're just tuning in the program, hour one, the first part is me talking about my accounting struggles. And then there's a plea for your assistance. I need you to put your thinking cap on relative to post-traumatic winning. Does it make sense, what I'm talking about? So any feedback's welcome. Any feedback's welcome. And again, if you haven't heard it, you'll hear me describe it. But, I describe life's journey as, especially after trauma enters your life, you're up in the air piloting your little Cessna through the weather, and some days the weather can be brutal, and some days it's not as tough. But if you can imagine on the tough days, your little Cessna flying in the threatening skies, right, cannot get above the cloud cover, and lightning and thunder and rain and wind blowing it around, hoping that it doesn't get cracked or doesn't crash or destroy. Okay, that's to me what the VA helps with, how to endure this. What post-traumatic winning does, it gives you a new joystick with different capabilities. Okay, and you take that joystick and you pull back on it and you go through those clouds. And we all know what's on the other side of the clouds, right? Sunshine, calmer skies, right? So that's what post-traumatic winning means. It promises you a brighter future, right? Not just the hope of enduring it better. And so I'm curious about what your thoughts are about that. So anyway, is there a better way to articulate it? All of that. So anyway, if you have thoughts, send them to me, mac.allmarineradio@gmail.com. Have a great day. I also talk about the NBA and what a clown show that is, right? How does a league, right, that honors Martin Luther King and is all about that, Right? How does it get, right, told to shut up in color by China and then does it? And you have the players, right, because you get near their money, right? We talk about social values and social issues, yet they got nothing to say about being the dancing chicken for a communist totalitarian regime. Yeah, well done. And they're pissed at the guy who created all this because he tweeted, "Stand with Hong Kong." Moderately wrong. Screwed up. But worst of all, right, how does the league that identifies itself with Martin Luther King and the values of Martin Luther King, right, not stand up and tell the truth when oppression is involved? And it's crazy to see it play out in public. Crazy. So anyway, you'll hear that too. So have a great day on a Tuesday. Oh, good news. Jack Riley's going to join us tomorrow. I'm fired up. Yeah, no kidding. Straight up fired up. He's one of my heroes, Jack Riley is. And he's just a good dude. But, a lot of, post-traumatic winning. You know, he's been one of the great inspirations to me of a guy who just did it, right? He just did it. Jack Riley, he's a great guy. So what I want to do is talk about with him, you know, none of this existed, no diagnosis, not shit. So when he came home, how did he, you know, how did he deal with it? Did he just, like, pack his shit away? Right? And over the course of the years, how did he evolve? You know, how did he evolve? So we'll talk to him about that. And then, which is always cool. I love talking to Jack Riley. And then, because he speaks Alabamese. Yeah. Goodness, Mike. I think that's one word, Jack. It's not two. It's, I think, isn't it goodness? Have a great day. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio is over and out. I promise you, it's getting out here momentarily. But I gotta turn this son of a bitch on. And I'm struggling with it right now. Oh! Stand by.